evening, depending on when you are listening or watching this episode of the Cricket Her Weekly, which happens to be episode number 198. Sid, Australia v India has been going on this week, and that's what we're going to be talking about in this week's episode. Now, it's been a bit of an odd one because we are recording this on Sunday morning, UK time, so we've only had one of the T20s so far, but basically what's happened is that Australia were pretty dominant in the three ODIs. The second one was a bit closer, but they won all three, so they whitewashed India in the ODIs, and the last one they won by 190 runs, which is a huge amount. Then in the first T20, India totally reversed it and won it by 9 wickets. Now, possibly by the time that people are watching or listening to this, the second match will have happened and whatever is going to happen in that will have happened. But for India to turn that around in such a short space of time with that switch between formats is quite interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a roller coaster.
It's welcome to 2024.
Straight out of Thorpe Park. It's the high of the test as they've shot down with the low of the ODIs. I mean, second ODI, the score, one of those ones, Australia seems to do this a lot. One of those ones where the scoreboard looks close, but if you were watching the game, it was never in doubt that Australia were always going to win that game.
Yeah.
Somehow it just didn't feel like it was going to be one that India could win, despite the fact that I think it was 6 runs there, was it the margin
only,
in the end?
I think it was only anyway, 3 or 4.
It wasn't very much. It was a handful, but really not. And then, India have rushed up again. As I say, we're looking forward to watching the second T20 this afternoon. But, they really did come back in the T20 series. I mean, the first thing for me was Shefali Verma. So she's been dropped for the second two ODIs.
Yeah.
I mean, she's been in and out of the ODI side. It was really interesting because she didn't play any ODIs for a long time. She 50-odd T20 caps, was it, before she made her ODI debut? It was a lot of T20 caps. So it was a very experienced player, and they've never quite thought, well, is she right for the ODI format? And obviously, they're still not convinced about her in the ODI format.
Convinced.
But, what way to answer the selectors than by coming back and hitting a stunning 50, and she really does continue to show that she is more than a sort of flash in the pan, whack it player that we thought at the first that she might be. When she first came onto the scene, she was obviously like a really exciting and it was a little bit like Grace Harris, that she'd come in and whack it, but we're like, oh yeah, but can she really play when it comes down to it? And she's definitely shown that she can. That made a big difference. That got off India off to the batting start they wanted. It meant that Smriti was able to relax a little bit in that innings. She did go a little bit. She kind of accelerated at the end, and she did end up sort of actually doing that classic thing of they needed 6 to win or something, and that
she got out
trying to hit the 6 to win. But I guess when you've got 10 wickets in hand, you can kind of do that.
Yeah.
Although interesting, I still feels like the kind of thing Australia wouldn't do. that on Australia would
they're
have
very
just
clinical.
Given that they had like
that's their approach, isn't it?
Yeah.
Clinical. But I have to say that watching that first T20, it was really interesting, and I did actually tweet this that Australia did that same thing that they did a couple of times during the Ashes, where when it's going wrong, and with Alyssa Healy as captain, they're just not quite sure what to do when that happens. It's like they've got these plans, and then when they're not working, they're just suddenly a bit like...
Suddenly you see a few grumpy faces.
And they're so unfamiliar with that scenario and with that kind of situation of, oh my goodness, we're on the ropes here, what do we do?
How dare they bowl us up?
That the players are just... don't quite know how to cope with it somehow, whereas I think other teams are much more used to dealing with that adversity.
And England are used to dealing with
England certainly are used to dealing with adversity, and whereas Australia aren't so much, and so it really did feel a little bit deja vu from the Ashes in that first T20.
It certainly did. But I mean, full credit to India having kind of roared back, and it really does feel like the T20 format is like the key one for them, at the moment going forwards. And not bad timing, given that there is a T20 World Cup coming up in Asia this year.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's going to be September, October. We don't have the dates for it yet. But it feels very much like India are focusing on that. Now, there was an interesting discussion actually about this week about the fact that India don't have any more international scheduled as it stands until August. But in the interim, what they do have is the second edition of the WPL. Again, date's not officially confirmed, but it looks like it's going to be late February. early March. And that's obviously going to be a huge focus for the Indians.
Yeah, and what an opportunity again for these players. I mean, the India have really taken advantage of it, haven't they? They've seen which players were performing in the first edition of the WPL. They've brought some of those players. We've seen a few debuts in this, and a few successful debuts. We often see people come in where you go, okay, well, their debut is inevitable, and you know we expect someone to debut at this time or at that time. But India have been very much they've gone, well, you've performed in that environment, you've performed, you know, with big crowds and things. You're going to come into the team, and we're going to make the most of you. And those people have been successful, so that's been a really big positive for them. And it really feels like they're pushing that T20 format. And the Indians love that T20 format. I mean, we've seen the crowd for the first T20. I think there were probably more people in the stadium for that first T20 than there'd been in all of the ODIs and the tests.
More than 20,000 people.
And so the Indians love their T20 cricket, and you know, if ultimately they can pull through this and, you know, use the experience of WPL, one thing that could be huge in WPL, they're talking about, we still don't know for certain, we're talking about using more grounds, so not just using the two grounds in Mumbai and New Mumbai, that in fact the same two grounds that they've used for the England and Australia series this winter. They're talking about expanding it a little bit. We still don't know exactly whether they're going to do that, and of course they might wind up bottling it, but again, giving those players the experience of playing in big stadiums elsewhere is also going to be a huge positive. So this Indian side are going to be really ready for that T20 World Cup, I think. And, you know, is that the team that your money are on for this T20 World Cup? Because, you know...
Well, it certainly isn't on Australia, I'm afraid, after that first T20. I think it's really interesting that Australia clearly... still able to display that level of dominance in ODIs, but in the shorter format, arguably a little bit of a fickler format, or maybe a levelling format is a better way of looking at it.
Oh, well, Raf. And it's very interesting you said that, because a lot of people talk about that, and in fact that's actually not true. Look at the statistics in women's cricket over the last sort of 4 or 5 years, and it's not true that T20 is a levelling format at all. In fact, T20 is a more predictable format in terms of ICC rankings than ODIs. But
well, I know that that's what the stats say, but in terms of kind of a common sense perspective, or just a way of trying to understand this sort of switch between an India who looked absolutely hapless against Australia in a longer format, now walked all over them in that first T20, and it's just about trying to understand what's really going on there. I think one other thing I will say is that I think that India's fielding in the ODIs was in some cases very poor. That one of those Smriti Mandana dropped catches was probably on the boundary. I can't remember who it was that she dropped, but it was one of the worst dropped catches I've ever seen in international cricket.
Yeah, through her hands onto them.
And you would expect somebody with that level of experience to take it. And you know, there were a kind of a litany of those mistakes going on. And I do think that in 50 over cricket, those mistakes cost you a lot more than they do in 20 over cricket, for the very obvious common sense reason that if you drop somebody in the first over of a 20 over game, they can only then bat for another 20 overs. If you drop them in the first over of a 50 over game, they can bat for 50 overs. So, you know, it's not rocket science. I'm doing all of the really technical analysis here for our Cricket Her viewers, but it's not rocket science. But I think it does bear repeating that India were poor in the field, and that did cost them in the ODIs.
Yeah, and that's something that, I mean, you know, every run counts kind of thing. And there are things that the Indian coaching people can work on. They can work on running between the wickets. They're definitely not as good as England. They're not as sharp as England are in that respect. Probably not as sharp as Australia are. I think that England remain the champion in terms of running between the wickets. Mm-hmm. And yeah, as you say, the fielding. I mean, we saw that in the test against England as well. You know, if obviously India won the test against England convincingly.
Pretty convincingly, yeah.
If they fielded, you know, with the same kind of standards as they batted and bowled,
they could have won it by an innings.
They could have really won it.
Yeah, so it's an interesting one. So despite people kind of, or some journalists expressing concern about the lack of ODI cricket that India have got coming up, actually you've just said you're not really concerned about that, Sid, because of the WPL.
And ultimately, you know, their goal seems to be this T20 World Cup. And if they go through and win this T20 World Cup, then, you know, they'll become legends. You know, India's a disappointed country at the moment because of what happened in the men's ODI World Cup. You know, they were expecting to win that. They were probably the best team. You know, and ultimately, you know, they were beaten in the final. But, you know, if Harmanpreet's side can go and win that T20 World Cup, you know, that will kind of paper over, you know, all of those wounds, or plaster over all of those wounds, and they'll become legends. They'll be known forever for having done that.
Yeah, and I do think you're right that there is that the BCCI are kind of strategically focusing more on 20 over cricket, and one other indicator of that would of course be the fact that they didn't play any ODIs against England, did they? They only played the Test and the T20s, and perhaps that's an indication of where the BCCI see women's international cricket and men's international cricket.
Well, I think they see international cricket
developing over the next few years.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's a really important point. The BCCI definitely, I mean, you can there's a difference perhaps between seeing sort of men's and women's games holistically and going, well, actually, we just kind of see everything through the prism of the men's game, and therefore we'll kind of project that onto the women's game. But it's certainly the case in the men's game that they go, well, we've got T20 cricket, which is your money generating big format, and we've got Test cricket, which, you know, we remain committed to because, you know, the players continue to believe it's the pinnacle of the
format,
game. And, you know, ODIs, you know, and we've seen that suggestions that even the men's ODI World Cup might be something that's in trouble. To be fair, we haven't seen any suggestions that the women's ODI World Cup will be
but
in trouble.
But there was an interesting interview that Tammy Beaumont did at the back of last year where she said, oh, we need to be really careful about protecting ODI cricket and the ODI format. So I do think that there are some concerns amongst the players that if the ODI format falls out of favour in men's cricket, that that will then have a knock-on effect within the women's game, which often it does, unfortunately.
So we're definitely seeing that, you know, all three formats remain important.
Absolutely.
All three formats are our favourite format.
yes, absolutely. Shall we talk a bit about Phoebe Litchfield's hit? Because obviously she's certainly been making the headlines at the start of 2024, hasn't she? Just had a phenomenal run of form with the bat against India.
Yeah, and, you know, when she's trying to hit runs against Pakistan in the Pakistan series for Australia, I think there was still, you know, still a little bit of scepticism, like, you know, is this really a player for the long term, or is she just someone that's come in and people don't really know how to bowl to her yet? Is she going to get found out? But in this series, she's really grown up, and she's, you know, shown what she's capable of. And you've all seen the stats about how, you know, she's the first person to hit, you know, this many runs at this age since Meg Lanning, you know, and whether she's a future Meg Lanning and all that stuff. I just want to take my hat off and kind of eat some words, really, because I was one of the ones that was skeptical. In fact, to be fair to myself, I think that I was right to be sceptical, because you never know. But she's really come in, and she's almost matured in front of us in such a short period of time. She's really developed, and that's the key to it for me, that it's a degree of development and kind of improving her game. And she just looks so elegant. She looks like a sort of left-handed Sarah Taylor sometimes with those cover drives. You know, and Sarah Taylor, I think, is, you know, the most elegant cricketer, you know, that we've seen for a long, long time in, you know, in men's or women's cricket. You know, the kind of echoes of watching David Gow when I was a kid, and, you know, that
who?
Elegance.
Who?
Yeah. and Phoebe Litchfield, for me, is like that. She's gorgeous to watch. She can play the proper cricket shots. She can play the modern cricket shots. And I just feel that, you know, she's really staking a claim to be the future in a way that I didn't kind of expect. I thought that we would be talking about Alice Capsey as being, you know, kind of the best player in the world in these years to come.
Well, it's actually really interesting to compare Phoebe Litchfield and Alice Capsey. You know, similar age, similar kind of stage of their career. And who is tearing up world cricket at the moment? Well, we wanted it to be Alice Capsey, but really it's more Phoebe Litchfield.
Yeah, Phoebe Litchfield is absolutely dominating. So Phoebe Litchfield scored more runs in the ODI series, more ODI runs, than Alice Capsey scored ODI runs in her entire career. Now, we're not talking about a huge heap more games, but we are talking about, you know, only a three-game series compared to Alice Capsey's 8 ODIs, I think she's played.
I don't know how many, it's only a handful.
And, you know, yeah, Alice Capsey's still going ahead and winning games for England, you know, and there's still this huge positive of games like Lords and things. But, you know, Phoebe Litchfield just has stepped up onto another level. And she's done it against, you know, the best bowling attack in the world. Certainly the best bowling attack that she could play against. I mean, you know, let's think about, you know, Phoebe Litchfield competing against, you know, the likes of England and Pakistan. But if you had, like, an England-India combined team, most of your bowlers, I think, would come from the Indian team, wouldn't they? You know, Pooja Vastrika and Ranuka Singh and, you know, Dipti Sharma and
Snehrana.
You know, they I mean, obviously Sophie Eccleston would be the first thing on the team sheet, but I suspect the next four or five would be Indians. So Phoebe Litchfield stood up and done it against the best bowling attack in the world and, you know, been dominant for an entire series.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just feel that, you know, she has shown us that she really, really is the real deal. And I know that a lot of Australian friends have been hoping and saying that, but I think
did you know, by the way, that she's from Orange? Don't know if that's ever been talked about.
I don't know if it's ever been mentioned by Mel Farrell on Twitter 500 times.
No, I don't know. I've never heard that. Just suddenly read it the other day. The other important thing for Lichfield, actually, though, has been the opportunities that she's been given by Australia, right? To actually, you know, be given that opportunity to open the batting, for example. And she did it in the Ashes test as well, didn't she? Those are the kind of opportunities where you go, well, would she have got that, for example, if she was that age and she was playing for England? You know, people like Capsey and Dunkley a few years ago really had to fight so hard, even to get into the top six. And, you know, look at the way that England treated somebody like Bess Heath last summer, coming into her first kind of in England squads. And she just got picked for that last ODI when the series was dead, and she was batting at
well down the order,
what,
whatever
six,
it was.
Six, yeah. Number six. Anyway, she wasn't coming in, you know, topping the order, and they weren't giving her that opportunity.
Yeah, that's what I mean. This was mentioned on the Britain Beamsy podcast, so a shout out to them for mentioning this. Christian Beams mentioned that, you know, a big deal was the fact that they kind of trusted her with that opening role in this series, and they obviously made her feel that, you know, that belonged to her and she was going to be comfortable there.
Yeah.
And you just thought of the contrast, because you can just see next summer England go, okay, come on then, we'll give Grace Scrivens a chance, and they're going to bring Grace Scrivens in, they're going to bat her at seven in an ODI or something. And
exactly.
It's just like, that's, you know,
and if all goes to plan, then
that's,
you
not
get
where
no opportunity,
be.
Right? And so you either have to bank on, I think we've talked about this before, you either have to bank on your team being
collapsing.
In really serious trouble, and you then walking out to bat for the first time in an international, or you get no opportunity at all. It's really hard luck.
Yeah, and particularly for a player like Grace Scrivens that so clearly is an opening batter. Yeah,
absolutely.
And I can just see England. I mean, you know, prove me wrong, guys.
Yeah, let's hope so. Now, the other person that we should really talk about a little bit just before we wrap up here, Sid, is Elise Perry, who in a few hours' time is all being well. I mean, let's hope she doesn't do a Glenn McGrath in 2005 and tread on a ball straight before the match. But all being well, will be playing in her 300th international for Australia in a few hours' time. What an amazing milestone. And there's obviously been a lot of talk about this on social media. And one of the questions that's being asked is, your favourite Elise Perry moment. Now, there are plenty to choose from. I've got to say that the little devil that sometimes sits on my shoulder said to me, oh, I remember your favourite Elise Perry moment, Raph. It was when she celebrated her double 100 in the 2017 Ashes Test match, the day-night Test match. And then it wasn't her double 100 because she thought that she'd hit a six and it was actually a four. So she prematurely celebrated her double 100 and then was really embarrassed because it wasn't. And who was batting at the other end? It was Megan Shute, who was just absolutely doubled up with laughter at the other end, could not keep a straight face, and it was really rather hilarious. Now, of course, Elise Perry did then go on and actually hit her double 100 for real a couple of balls later, so all was well in the end, but it was just quite funny. But yeah, probably shouldn't have that actually as my favourite Elise Perry moment. What was your favourite Elise Perry moment, Sid?
Well, I mean, obviously, you know, the Elise Perry moment everyone remembers is all those wickets at Canterbury.
Yeah, 7 for 22, wasn't it?
England,
oh, my goodness.
She destroyed them so much that basically none of the England players would come out to face a press conference, and poor old Robbo had to do it for them.
You know what? I was in an interview with Nat Siver recently. I was talking to her about Elise Perry, and I was talking to her about her own record against Australia, which is obviously really good with the bat. And she said, yeah, I like to feel like I do a little bit to Australia now when I come out to bat that we used to feel when Elise Perry came out to bat against us, which was basically like you watch them come out and you're just so flipping annoyed to see them. You just want them to turn round and walk back into the pavilion because you just can't stand the sight of them. So she's now doing to Australia what she thinks that Elise Perry did to England a couple of years ago. Anyway.
Yeah, but for me as well, I wanted to kind of relate a little anecdote from last summer about the kind of person that Elise Perry is. Because
okay.
I thought this was really interesting. It's a little kind of peek behind the scenes, and a peek behind the scenes for me as well. We went to a reception at the Australian Embassy where the Australian team were invited to this reception. You know, and the Australian Embassy in London is this gorgeous building with gold
stunning
leaf everywhere. And
so it was where, if anyone's watched the Harry Potter movies, it's where Gringotts Bank was the location for Gringotts Bank. So you get an idea of the scale.
Yeah. So and we're in this huge room, and then you know everybody's gathered and you know has a glass of Australian champagne.
Yeah.
And then the Australian team walk in.
See, is there such a thing as Australian champagne? I think the French might take issue. Sorry, I'm interrupting your Relief Perry anecdote.
So the entire squad walk in, and you know they're clapped in, and you know the entire squad walk to the front. You know, and Elizabeth Healy is doing a Q&A, and you know they're all taking the plaudits. One person stayed at the back, and it was Elise Perry. She just stayed quietly at the back. She made conversation with a couple of people that were there. She wasn't shy to you know talk to people, but she was just like you know I'm not going to go to the front. That's not me. I'm just going to stay at the back. I'm going to make conversation with a couple of people who were here, and I'm just going to be quiet and I'm just going to be me. And that's very much the kind of person that she is. You know, behind the scenes, she's actually kind of a sort of quiet, modest person, and she's not a shy person on a sort of personal level. You know, but she's someone that's that. She's completely the opposite of kind of that world boss thing.
Yes.
Not the world boss. She's just Elise Perry.
Yeah.
And I just kind of thought that was a really interesting thing about her personality.
Yeah, no, that's a lovely story. Thanks, Sid. Okay, well, let's hope that she has a good one in her 300th international. We'll be watching. And thank you, everybody, for tuning in. And we will see you in a week's time. Bye for now.
Bye.